How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Now playing Open Floor.
This is Open Floor. Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix back at it. An NBA podcast with Sports Illustrated senior writer.
I think it's time that the world get to know
my guy Chris Mannix.
I think your opinion is shared by everyone.
And now it begins.
Now it begins. Bang!
Welcome back to the Open Floor NBA podcast. We talk about the association, all the goings on in it. And this is always the biggest week of the NBA calendar, the first day of free agency and, well, first days, I should say. And they were wild ones. You know, a lot of movement, some restructuring of teams. But has the landscape shifted significantly? That's still somewhat of an open question. To help me break all of it down, I bring in my friend Mark Medina. Does a great job covering the NBA over at Sportskeeda, Fox Sports Radio, Sporting Tribune. Been covering hoops in Southern California for a long time. So, Mark, we have to start with the biggest news on Monday, and it wasn't even a transaction. The Boston Celtics are for sale. Yes, the Celtics, in a release, say that Wick Grosbeck, who is the majority owner of the Celtics, is going to sell his shares of the team and plans to do so by end of 2024, or early 2025. This is a pretty, you know, seismic announcement. I mean, the Celtics, in addition to being the NBA champions, they're also one of the most valuable properties in the entire NBA. I mean, they're a legacy franchise, you know, right up there with the Lakers and the Knicks, most championships in NBA history. We've seen valuations over the last couple of years get around $4.5 billion. Celtics, I think they're going to zoom past that. I think we're talking $5, maybe even $6 billion when it comes to a price tag for the Celtics. So just give me your reaction right off the bat to Wick Grosbeck announcing that the Celtics are for sale.
Well, I thought it was really fitting because they're shortly removed from winning their 18th championship. It was on the same day that news came out that, you know, Jason Tatum expectedly agreed to his new extension. Same thing with Derek White. So they're at their absolute peak value right now. The other question, and I'm curious to hear your take on it, is that while no doubt the Celtics are going to be selling at such an astronomical price because that's the reality that we live in, you did bring up some possible flashbacks, parallels to the Minnesota Timberwolves and their whole situation with the sale, where on one hand, you know, Glenn Taylor's trying to sell the franchise, but also give him wiggle room to come back after the fact if he wants to at least keep a portion of that. So I'm curious, how do you see that playing out potentially in Boston?
It was a two-paragraph statement that the Celtics released. One was, you know, interesting in one respect in that the reasons for selling was due to family and estate planning. I tried to get some clarification on what that means. I didn't get it. So I'm interested in that. But the second paragraph, to your point, you know, did have some Minnesota vibes. And that's not just me speaking there. I asked a couple of people in the league office, you know, when they read that, did they interpret it the same way I did, which is this could be a tiered sale process in Minnesota. You know, a few years ago, when the deal was first announced with Alex Rodriguez and Mark Lowry, they effectively tried to buy the Wolves via payment plan. They're still trying to buy the Wolves via payment plan. The release that the Celtics put out certainly suggested that was what Grosbeck was looking to do. In fact, it went as far as to say he plans on being the team governor through 2028. Like, that's 4 years from now. So I didn't get all that. I can say this, and I feel pretty confident, Mark, and I think you'd probably agree. If the Celtics attempted anything that looked anything like what happened in Minnesota, I think the NBA would put the kibosh on it quickly. I mean, Adam Silver came out, I believe it was during the finals, might have been before then, but right around that time, and effectively said, we're not doing that Minnesota stuff again, right? We're not doing this thing. Like, you either have the money to buy a team or you don't. And I think that's, you know, the lesson they learned from that entire Timberwolves process. I don't see the NBA kind of allowing the Celtics to sell this team or sell the majority shares of this team in chunks. It's probably going to be all or nothing for a sale to ultimately go through. And if a sale goes through as quickly as this release suggests, 24-25, there's no way that a new majority owner is going to let Wick Grousebeck be the, you know, governor of the team. And look, we saw this with the Mavericks and Mark Cuban just this past year. Like, Mark Cuban sold his majority stake in the team, still owns 27% of the team, but came out afterwards and effectively said, like, he's still going to be in the same role, running basketball operations, yada, yada, still be in charge. He's not. He's not. Patrick Dumont is now the governor of the team. And as far as I know, and this has been reported elsewhere, but, you know, the decision-making tree is Nico Harrison, the GM, to Patrick Dumont, the, you know, team's governor. So it seems unlikely that Wick Grousebeck would retain governorship of the team throughout this sales process. I think ultimately, if and when he decides to sell his shares, they are going to be sold in one big block. It's not going to be a situation like Minnesota. It's probably going to be more like what we saw in Phoenix, where, you know, Matt Ishbia bought the team on like Tuesday and he was running operations on Wednesday. So that's my read on it, Mark, that's more likely to be the chain of events.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that I was thinking about, more related to Mark Cuban when he sold his majority shares, is that clearly the NBA is in really good financial shape. They're on the cusp of having a very lucrative TV rights deal. But you do wonder, at the same time, are some of these owners trying to sell high while it's at its absolute peak before some kind of bubble bursts, whether it's because of revenue or, more importantly, you know, some of the punitive measures that we've already seen affect how teams have been operating, a la the second apron with free agency. So there's a weird set of contradictions that the NBA is going through right now, where clearly financially they're fine. It's a robust business, but there's a lot of restrictions and new challenges that every ownership and franchise are facing right now.
Well, let's address that, the why to all this, because when this was announced, it definitely was a shock, because in interviews, Wick has said publicly that the team is not for sale. I know he said it on a podcast with Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce. Adam Himmelsbach of The Globe wrote something about his conversation with Wick recently. He's been clear about that. So it was a shock to hear that he was going to sell the team. And this stuff we still don't know. We still don't know what family and estate planning means. I think that's an important part of all this. But if you kind of take a step back and look at this logically, if Wick Grousebeck did not see this team as a legacy part of his business, right, of his business portfolio, in other words, if he didn't see this team as being something he would hand down to his children, you know, years later, or other family members, if he didn't see that, and if he knew selling was going to happen at some point, he's 63 years old, if he knew it was going to happen at some point, there's probably no better time than right now to sell the team. Because, well, for a lot of reasons. One, the team is white hot. They just won a championship. Their core is young. They're the favorites going into next season. They just signed all their guys back. Like, the top nine of the Celtics is coming back intact. Like, that's unheard of in today's NBA. So you've got a team built to win right now. The other part of it is that the team is so expensive at the moment that in the next couple of years, those tax penalties are going to be massive. Like, we're talking, you know, payroll and luxury tax totals that exceed $450, maybe $500 million in the years ahead. So, you know, by putting the team up for sale now, Wick can avoid all that. He won't have to pay the tax penalty next year if he sells the team by the end of this year or early next season. And he can kind of walk away with the maximum possible return on his investment. And look, there are other factors too. I mean, the TV money now is pretty well known. It's probably going to be $7 billion per year, a massive haul, 2.5 times what the NBA is making at the moment. But the RSN money, the local TV money, it's not going to improve, right? Like, the RSNs are a mess right now. All, you know, we saw Bally's go out of business or go declare bankruptcy last year. It messed with a bunch of professional franchises. You know, the NBA, they've got their own concerns with these RSNs. Multiple franchises are basically starting their own, right? Like, you got Utah out there with its own direct-to-consumer stuff. Phoenix is doing a little bit of that. Other teams, I'm sure, are going to continue to do that. The Celtics do have one of the healthiest RSNs that are out there. NBC Sports Boston is pretty strong at the moment. And Boston and the Celtics do own a 20% equity stake in NBC Sports Boston. But the RSN business is not going to get better. And there's a pretty good chance in the years to come, the money coming in from that overall is going to decline. So to me, you kind of peel all that back, Mark. And again, if you're not going to, if you want to hold on to this for 20 something years, no reason to sell. But if you can see the light at the end of the tunnel, if you think there's an end coming for you, there's no better time than now to sell a team.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you hit all the buttons as far as why you would go out on this kind of high note. And when you're mentioning the RSNs, you obviously mentioned some examples here with the Celtics and the Suns. You know, the Lakers have had a robust RSN with Spectrum Sportsnet. But that development is one of many examples that the NBA has concerns of the difference between small, big markets or just legacy franchises versus franchises that don't move the needle. And they don't want that. That's not Adam Silver's vision with the NBA, where right now he wants that parity. He wants that competitiveness where we've seen ever since the Warriors dynasty has peeled back and shown signs of collapse that there hasn't been a repeat champion. So it's such an interesting time in the NBA, and all these seemingly contradictions that we're outlining, all of them are true. They are both happening at the same time, but it's hard to monitor at what times they all overlap.
So let's talk about potential buyers for a minute here. Because as we said, this is as in terms of teams coming up for sale and availability, you're not going to find outside of the Knicks and Lakers. There's no more bigger name team than the Celtics. Right. So I think the interest will be robust. We saw earlier today, Monday, that Steve Pagliuca, who is one of the more prominent minority owners of the team, said he planned to participate in the bidding process. And I think there's a lot of people inside the Celtics organization that would like Pagliuca to come out the winner of that bidding process. He's a very well-known guy within the organization, a well-liked guy within the organization, and the transition to from Grauspeck to Pagliuca as, you know, majority owner would be pretty seamless, I would imagine. The question is, does Steve have the financial resources to do something like that? Or can he cobble together the financial resources to do something? Because again, I do think the ultimate price exceeds $5 billion. That's kind of something that people have mentioned to me in league circles over the last 24 hours. And I think they're probably right. The door, I think, is open for a gambling entity to come in, a casino magnate to come in and make a play for the Celtics, because it's slowly becoming a trend here with this, right? You have, obviously, the Adelson family buying controlling interest in the Mavericks, and they did that in part because they want the Mavericks to be a centerpiece of, you know, a casino resort that they're hoping to build if and when Texas makes gambling statewide legal. In Vegas, you know, we both believe the NBA is eventually going to get to Vegas. Whenever that happens, more likely than not, an NBA team is going to be playing in a casino resort that's owned by the owner of that team. I don't think you'll see them playing in T-Mobile Arena, not at least in the long term, unless the MGM Grand is involved in it. But I think you're going to see a casino resort type of setup in Vegas as well. Massachusetts is interesting in that respect. The floodgates are wide open for sports gambling in Massachusetts. You can bet on your phone. It's one of the many states now that have made it accessible. There's also a recently opened Encore Casino that is just a metaphorical stone's throw from the TD Garden in Boston. It opened up in a town called Everett, which is right next door to the city. And it's, if you know anything about the Encore and the Wynn in Vegas, it looks exactly like the one that they have in Vegas. So could the owners at Encore and the Wynn get together and say, you know what would look good? If we could put a NBA arena right next to our casino resort and, you know, boost business that way, get people coming to games, and then hopefully they'll go over to the casino and play afterwards. So I do think you have to keep an eye on that. The Celtics have a long-term lease at TD Garden. That's obviously an issue. You know, would they move out of the city proper? I don't know if that would be the case either. But given the landscape, Mark, and the fact that to buy an NBA team, you have to have incredibly deep pockets. I don't think you can rule out the possibility that a deep-pocketed casino magnet would come in and try to buy up Grousbeck's shares of the Celtics and make it the centerpiece of a NBA venue, NBA-centric venue somewhere in Boston.
Yeah, and I think that every franchise, you know, is fluid as far as which candidates would be up for any potential purchase with an ownership. But I think when you look at recent history, there's been some common denominators. You mentioned any candidates that have ties to the gambling industry. Usually there's also someone who has ties to the tech industry. There's usually also a former athlete that wants to be part of an ownership group as another revenue stream, but they usually partner with an ownership group to kind of mitigate, you know, not the risk, but the amount of money that they have to, you know, put up financially. So that ties into what we're talking about with Minnesota with Alex Rodriguez. This isn't related to Boston, but it's down the line whenever and if it happens. But LeBron James has obviously put his name out there with wanting to be part of an ownership group, most notably in Las Vegas. So, you know, basically those three categories are probably going to be the trends moving forward for potential ownership purchases.
I believe, you know, one of the options, and again, we're all speculating right now with who might buy the, you know, the team or the shares of Wick Grousbeck. One of them is Fenway Sports Group, which is owned by John Henry, the owner of the Red Sox. You know who's a part of the Fenway Sports Group, Mark? LeBron James.
Yep.
Wouldn't that be something if a group that has LeBron James as part of it winds up buying the Boston Celtics? That would be interesting. Well,
what about Kevin Garnett, right? I mean, that whole relationship with Glenn Taylor did not lead to something because that relationship was fractured. But what about him with the Celtics? Could he
I think you can incorporate any of these big names, but it's all about who is putting up the lion's share of the money. Like where does that revenue come from? The other thing with the Celtics and why I bring up the idea of a kind of casino resort type of deal is that they don't own TD Garden. Right? Like that's a Bruins building. It's owned by the hockey owners. So, you know, they're basically long-term rentees of that building. And I know there definitely have been people in that organization over the years that wish they owned their own building. You know, they got a good setup there. It's in a good part of town. People like it. It was just recently renovated, but it is one of the older buildings of the NBA. It opened up in 1995. So it's been around for a while. So that whole situation is gonna be fascinating to see how it all unfolds. Like, can someone internally come up with the cash to make a seamless deal happen, or do we get some kind of Adelson-like, deep-pocketed owner that comes in and becomes the newest casino magnate to own an NBA team? All right, let's talk about some of the big deals that we saw this week in the NBA. And let's start with the Philadelphia Clippers situation. Philadelphia, of course, they signed Paul George, four-year, $212 million contract with Paul George. Paul George heads to Philadelphia, where he will form arguably the best big three in the NBA. I've been looking down at the list, Mark. I mean, there are probably better big twos than either Embiid and George or Embiid and Maxey, but I'm not sure there are better big threes in the NBA right now. Durant, Beal, Booker, I don't know. They didn't seem to work out that well last year in Phoenix. But it gives Philadelphia an all-star wing, a guy that shot the best numbers of his career from the field and three-point line last season, who played 74 games last season. So he proved to be durable last year. I know there were some people that had hoped that Philadelphia would kind of use all that cap space to mix and match and get two or three different guys. I don't. I think this was a great deal. I think Paul George as kind of 2A on that team opposite Tyrese Maxey is a home run. Paul George is adaptable. We saw that. He succeeded with Russell Westbrook in Oklahoma City, Kawhi Leonard, James Harden. He had to play with in L.A. I think he's going to be able to fit in seamlessly opposite, you know, Embiid and Maxey. He's obviously motivated at this stage to win championships because he's had a long career, made a lot of money, won absolutely nothing at this point. So I don't know about you. I love the fit of Paul George with the 76ers.
Oh, great fit. And it was the 100% right move. And this has been the Sixers' priority, you know, for a while now, that they want to get a really good two-way wing player to complement Tyrese Maxey and Joel Embiid. You know, these aren't game changers, but it also helps that, you know, they did add some extra players with Eric Gordon, Andre Drummond, just to get some depth. I think you hit on a really good note with Paul George. He can fit in with anybody, and he is a great two-way player. He's very good at being, you know, either the number one, number two, number three player. I think because of that, on paper, they would be second in the East behind the Boston Celtics, because, as you mentioned, Celtics basically have their whole championship core back, and they are a well-oiled machine. But we do have to bring up the injury concerns, not just with Joel Embiid, but even though Paul George had relatively better health last season, injuries are still a thing to monitor him, monitor with Paul George. The other thing that's an interesting irony with PG is that even though he is very good at adapting to his role, playing like a star player or being a glue guy or a role player or a mix of both, there have been moments during his time with the Clippers when Kawhi Leonard was out and he was being asked to carry the team. He showed glimpses of being comfortable with that, but it could only sustain for so long. He didn't seem comfortable with being the long-term number one guy. And with Philadelphia, he's clearly not the number one guy, but if heaven forbid there is a long-term injury that Joel Embiid has, I think that he could only hold the fort down for so long. But to your point, big picture, it's the move they had to make. Doesn't guarantee anything in the NBA, but the bottom line is you have to do what you can to give yourselves the best chance to win an NBA championship. And the Sixers have been, you know, underachieving the last few years because of injuries biting themselves at the worst opportune times.
Yeah, and I don't worry about Paul George, whether or not he's able or not able to step in and play a bigger role in the case of a serious injured Embiid. It's like with every team in the NBA, Mark, like you lose your best player, you're done. You're cooked. Like Tatum goes down in Boston, they're done. Jalen Brunson goes down in New York, they're done. Like, yeah, and no question, like Embiid's got to find a way to be healthy when the playoffs start. I mean, I'd like to see him play 55 to 60 games next year. Like, don't worry about all NBA. Don't worry about crossing that 65-game threshold to win whatever awards. Just get that body at full strength to the postseason. Like, because, you know, he's going to wind up playing 35, 40 minutes a game in the playoffs. And, you know, we watched his past postseason. Like, even though he was kind of officially healthy-ish, he still was dragging that body around for much of the playoffs. So, you know, Embiid, I think, has to find a way to just ease into the postseason as close to full strength as he possibly can be. But fit-wise, it just works. It just works. I mean, Paul George is going to get a lot of open looks playing opposite Maxey and Embiid. He's going to be able to be a playmaker because Maxey is, you know, most of the time more of a scorer than he is a traditional playmaker. I think it's a round peg, round hole type of fit. I'm not surprised at all to see Philadelphia go to the mat and offer up all those years for Paul George. And look, maybe at the back end, it's a shitty contract, but whatever. Like, you've got like a 3 or 4 year window with Joel Embiid. Like, this is where you maximize his potential. And going all in on Paul George, it's worth the risk of a couple of bad years on the back end of that deal. From the Clippers' perspective, I don't really know what they're doing. I don't. They were very clear and adamant that they were not going to go to a fourth year with Paul George. They were very clear that the best Paul George could hope for with them was the kind of 3-year contract that they gave Kawhi Leonard. I don't know why they held that position, because look, they knew Philadelphia was out there. right? Like if Paul George only had like, even if it was just Orlando, right? Like you're going to look at Paul George, like you really going to go to Orlando? Like you're really going to spend the next 4 years of your career trying to win in Orlando. But they knew Philadelphia was lurking. They knew, you know, the kind, like Daryl Morey doesn't, when stars are available, Daryl Morey goes after him. That's his MO. So they knew the Sixers were going to do exactly what they did. And yet they held firm and wouldn't give Paul George that fourth year, which I guess is admirable in a way. But now what are they left with? Now you've got a 30-something-year-old Kawhi Leonard who has a history of injuries. You've got a 30-something-year-old James Harden who has a history of injuries. They went out and went on this like quasi-spending spree, you know, over the last couple of days where they signed Derek Jones Jr. and Mo Bamba and Chris Dunn, Nick Batum, you know, bringing back Kevin Porter Jr. Apparently they were competing with lots of teams for him. I don't know if I believe that. But like they signed a bunch of guys. And as I watch all these transactions with the Clippers, Mark, the only thing I can think of is like the Clippers, they look like a team that is trying to do whatever they can to avoid giving Oklahoma City two good draft picks over the next 2 years, because the Thunder are sitting pretty right now. They have got the rights to the Oklahoma City draft pick, or the Clippers draft pick next year, and then swap rights in 2026 on their draft pick. So the Clippers have no reason to lose here. Like they need to be as competitive as possible. And that to me is how they are operating right now. Just signing a bunch of guys that if they're all healthy, they're a play-in team. Like, I saw like on Twitter, people like going after me like, did you watch enough Paul George this year? Like Paul George isn't that good. Paul George is a negative. Paul, no, get rid of Paul George. We're still going to be the fourth seed in the East or the West. No, you're not. No, you're not. If you think that, you are delusional. If you think that some combination of Nick Batum and Derek Jones Jr. and Kevin Porter Jr. are going to step in and replace the production of Paul George, you are crazy. That's my take on it, Mark. What's yours?
Yeah, it's fairly similar. Now, I'll share with you and feel free to knock it down. This is just the Clippers' thought process, is that it's very telling that they cited the second apron concerns multiple times.
Three times.
It doesn't. I don't think Steve Ballmer is, worried about his money inflow. He's shown that he's had willingness to spend, but I think that they had long term concerns for future seasons on how hamstrung it would make them with, you know, rounding out the rest of their roster and diluting their effectiveness of having a full mid level. They wouldn't say this, but I can't help but think that they were sensitive to the optics of giving Paul George a longer deal than Kawhi Leonard, because Kawhi Leonard already committed, gave a little bit of a pay cut to theoretically make it more feasible for everyone to still stay on a contract. So I think that they didn't want to disrupt that. But the other thing that is puzzling is, you know, I've been told, and I know it's also out there among other reporters, is the Warriors propose several different variations of possible signing trades involving some of their veteran players. So you look at some combinations of Chris Paul and Andrew Wiggins, Kevon Looney. There are even variations that included some of their young players like Jonathan Kuminga, and the Clippers still said no to that.
Do you believe that though? Like, I don't, like, they're not trading Kuminga to get Paul George. Like, I don't believe that. Like, I just don't. Kuminga.
I don't believe that they included all those names, but at least from what was relayed to me, that there were variations of different combinations to make a sign and trade happen so that Paul George could get a max with the Warriors. And the Warriors liked him for the same reasons Philadelphia liked him. And the Clippers said no. Now the Clippers said in their statement generally that they declined doing any sign and trades because of the second apron concerns. But to your point, that part made me scratch my head a little bit, because the Warriors at least had some assets to work with, especially with their young guys, and they said no to that still.
Yeah, look, the second apron concerns are legit. Like,
yeah,
you mentioned this. Like, Steve Ballmer's not afraid of paying luxury tax penalties, but the reality is when you go into that second apron, your ability to flesh out your roster becomes significantly more difficult. So I get that. I just think that ultimately – the Clippers, they made their deal with the devil years ago. Like, they brought these guys in It was the right move at the time. Both of them in their 20s, true all-stars. Kawhi coming off a championship. I get it. But I think they almost I would have doubled down on it. I would have said, you know what? This is who we are. We're going to bring James Harden back. The Harden deal was wild to me. Like, you're bringing James Harden back on a two-year deal at $70 million. Who are you bidding against? Like, who exactly was out there looking to give James Harden more than, say, the mid-level exception? If that. Like, James Harden's what, 35, 36 years old? Who was out there that wanted to give him 2 years and $70 million? Like, I like to think I'm decently plugged in across the NBA. I don't know who that was. I don't know who the Clippers were sitting back going, oh, man, we got to give James Harden $70 million because, you know, the Dallas Mavericks, you know, they're clearing cap space. Or Orlando, you know, the Orlando Magic, which prioritized defense more than any team in the league, they're going to give James Harden $35 million a year. Like, who were they bidding against? That was wild to me, Mark. Like, of all the things that went down, like, if they get James Harden back in, like, 2 years, $25 million, I'm like, all right, cool. That's what it is in the NBA. But $35 million? Like, James Harden, this man keeps winning. Like, he just keeps winning. Not on the court, but off the court. He keeps winning. He everywhere he goes, he winds up getting paid. And if he doesn't like it there, he forces his way out to exactly where he wanted to go, and he gets paid again. Like, this guy is a off-season winner.
You could say that, but at the same time, say he does not demand a trade with Philadelphia, right? They got Paul George because they had him off the books, and you do wonder if he had just played out the rest of this past season, even though he's upset with Daryl Morey, not that he would have gotten Paul George's deal, but he would have gotten rewarded in some respect, and now you weigh which team has a better chance to win a championship. But I think to your broader point, yeah, he didn't have a robust market, but internally – the Clippers were relatively pleased that he was able and willing to adjust his game, adjust his role, still be productive. And I think that they were comforted with the fact that even though it was $35 million a season, it was 2 years as opposed to a multi-year contract. So there is some more flexibility than otherwise.
You're crazy. you're crazy.
I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just relaying what they're thinking.
Oh, no, I've heard it. I mean, I've heard it. I don't buy it that one bit. Like, you could have gotten James Harden for a lot less. You could have. I'm sorry. And meanwhile, you know, one of the byproducts of this Philadelphia Paul George deal, and you touched on it briefly, is like the Sixers own two first-round picks of the Clippers. In 2028, they got the pick outright. And I believe in 2029, they have swap rights to that Sixers pick. So not only do they get better in Philadelphia by adding Paul George, but they weaken a team that in 3-4 years, they've got their first-round picks. Like, it's a double whammy for Daryl Morey and the 76ers. I don't know. I mean, again, it just seems like the only objective of the Clippers is not to bottom out, because if they bottom out, they wind up like the Brooklyn Nets of the last decade, where they're forking over two top three picks that turn into superstars for other teams, right? Like, you know, the Brooklyn Nets will forever be known as the team that gave the Celtics Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. Like, that, I think, that I feel like the Clippers are operating like that. They're not trying to win anything, because they know they can't win anything with this group, but they're just trying to be as competitive as humanly possible, so whatever draft picks they got to fork over are not as bad as they potentially could be. You mentioned Golden State, which is now going through a transition of its own. Klay Thompson officially gone from the Warriors, 3-year deal, $50 million with Dallas. Thompson chooses the Mavericks over the Lakers. From what I heard, it's a lot of financial reasons, Mark. I mean, I don't know if the Lakers could have offered what the Mavericks did. I don't think so. But even if they could match the dollar-dollar offer, the taxes are totally different in California and Texas. Like, there's just so much more money Klay Thompson is going to make by playing in Texas with the Mavericks. And look, I think he's a decent fit, you know, playing opposite Kyrie and Luka Doncic. Both those guys are magnets for defensive attention. And even though Klay's shooting numbers went down to like 38% last season, I think the looks he's going to get in Dallas might even be better than what he was getting in Golden State next year. So I do. I love the deal for the Dallas Mavericks. Let's start there. I mean, how much better did the Mavericks get with Klay Thompson? And I guess we can talk a little bit about how they kind of swapped out Najee Marshall for Derek Jones Jr. At the small forward position.
Yeah, I mean, they got substantially better because the last two off seasons, the strategy has been, let's try to get great supporting cast players so that's not just Luka and Kyrie. I mean, obviously it starts with them, but how do we make life easier for them so that they're not always getting double teams? And if they are getting double teams, they find open guys that can make shots. Obviously, Klay can do that with his outside shooting. I think even though he went through some frustrations this past season with accepting a bench role, in fairness, he's shown adaptability and being able to excel in that. So I don't think it's going to get to that point. But if there are times where Jason Kidd feels like, hey, let's stagger lineups, there is flexibility to that. I think, though, that Klay Thompson defensively is not anywhere near what he could ever restore pre-ACL injury in 2019. He's been a willing defender, but he's not that lockdown defender that he once was. And so that's really the only the real limitation that I don't think that that's ever going to be restored. But to your point about Dallas, Lakers, I think the Lakers fit was fine too for almost the exact same reasons. And even though he wouldn't provide as much point of attack defense, they got good front court depth with Anthony Davis to help most notably. But I think really the sticking point is the Warriors didn't view the Lakers as viable sign and trade candidates. I mean, they didn't really have assets they wanted. I think most notably, they didn't have any interest in D'Angelo Russell. They had a lot of familiarity with what he could provide. Ironically, they got D'Angelo Russell in that sign and trade with Kevin Durant. And part of it was because they knew Klay Thompson was out for that whole 2019-20 year. And while they didn't anticipate Steph Curry being out only four games into that season, they saw, for better and for worse, what D'Angelo Russell can provide. Good playmaking, but inconsistent as a shooter. Has flashes of great shooting, but then lots of games where he can't hit a shot. And then defensively, yeah, he's shown improvements, but nothing dramatic. And they didn't have interest in relitigating that again.
So now you got the Warriors sitting out there with Steph, who's still playing at a high level. Draymond still playing at kind of a B level for Draymond. Not quite the defensive player he used to be, but still an effective guy, especially as a playmaker on the offensive end. But, you know, around them, you've got, you know, Kuminga, you've got Moody, you've got Andrew Wiggins, you got Kevon Looney. Like, but what else? Like, this was a team that didn't make the playoffs last year. I don't know what their play is, Mark. I don't know where they go from here. Like, again, I sort of take it, and I say this all the time here on the show, but like I kind of watched GMs work most closely in Boston, where Danny Ainge operated, where Danny was always like, you know what, we're either going to be really good or we're going to be really bad. And look, the reality is a lot of great teams are built that way. The teams that we've seen built, you know, recently, you know, Boston was really bad for a number of years. Oklahoma City had that one terribly, whether it was like 29 games in a row or something that year, one year. You know, Denver had down years. The Warriors right now are kind of on the precipice here. Like, I don't know what move they can make to build a winner around Steph. Like, you know, DeMar DeRozan is still out there as a possibility for both the Warriors and the Lakers, I guess. But I don't know if DeRozan at this stage moves the needle, not substantially. So I don't know where the Warriors go from here, Mark. Like, you know, Chris Paul's now gone. Klay Thompson is now gone. Like, it just feels like they've got Steph and a lottery team around him. What are you seeing?
Yeah, and I think the other thing, they really missed an opportunity. I mean, obviously it takes two to tango, but ideally their hope was that they could package some combination with Chris Paul and Andrew Wiggins and get something in return. And they weren't able to do that with Chris Paul, and they just waived him. There's still hope that maybe at some point now, or, you know, leading to the trade deadline, they can do that with Andrew Wiggins. But Andrew just hasn't been the same player that he was during the 2022 championship season. So his value is going down. This might be, I think, their way of rationalizing and also some fool's gold, but this is what their current thought process is. Clearly, the dynasty years are over. They have been over for a while. This is just another signal of it. But they do think there is a pathway for them to at least be a playoff team because, yeah, Steph Curry is still playing at a high level. But while they're not naive to think that Draymond will never have another injury, never get a technical or get ejected, they have relative optimism that his severity of absences last season won't be duplicated. So he'll be more available. And when Draymond's been on the court, he, with exception of officials, he's been a good defender.
This is where you're losing me. You're losing me. Like, they have a level. What was the phrase there? A level of optimism that Draymond won't, you know,
will be more available.
We're basing that on.
They are not saying he's never going to get another technical or another.
Are we crossing our fingers and hoping?
They're saying severity that
wish
he's
upon
be
a star
more available than last season. The third part, and this is realistic, is that Jonathan Kuminga and Brandon Podzimski and Moses, yes, they're going to develop more and more. So what does that get them? No, championships out the window, but at least there's a pathway where they can be a playoff team. But again, everything has to hit right. And to your point, I share the skepticism about Draymond avoiding injuries or any suspensions. But again, last season was such a cluster, you know what, with him, that there's no way that it can't go up, right?
Well, it's not impossible that it can go down too, right? last season was a mess, but it was a mess of his own making. It wasn't like there was some outside influence here. Like, Draymond self-destructed for parts of the season, and the Warriors paid the price for it. Now, they're down Klay Thompson. No, they're down Chris Paul. Chris Paul was pretty good, you know, in the games that he played, especially early on. Like, his numbers are not bad. And they're counting on these young guys to take not just one, but probably two or three steps forward. Like, I agree. I think these guys can play. I think Podzimski can play. I think Kuminga can play. Less certain about Moody, but you know, there's certainly potential there. But again, like, the ceiling is relatively low for that. Like, the ceiling is the play-in, maybe the sixth seed. Maybe, but I'm still thinking play-in might be their top level. Like, the reality is, like, if you're just looking at this objectively, the course of action is to trade Steph Curry. They're not going to do it. I'm not sitting there suggesting that. But that's the most prudent way to go. Like, you've got decent young talent on your roster. You put Steph on the market, you're probably going to get a boatload back, whether it's draft picks or young players. I don't know. Like, I guess it's more important to keep Steph in a Warriors uniform for the totality of his career. But Mark, you and I both know that doesn't happen really anymore. Like, you know, guys want to wind up playing, you know, years past when their franchise wants to keep paying them. And that's just the reality of the situation. Like, if you're the Warriors, to me, your pathway is to trade Steph to a contender that, you know, wants to give you a ton back in return. Trade Draymond to, like, Detroit. You know, you'd probably take him up there with that contract and rebuild. Like, rebuild. They've got their draft capital. Like, it's not, they're on the same position as the Clippers. Like, they've got their draft picks. And I think they've got a couple extra ones too in the coming years. They're not going to do it. I'm not sitting here saying they're going to do it. In fact, I'm actively sitting here saying they're not going to do it. But, yeah. Like, one option is to bring as many talented players as you can back and compete for a play-in spot. It's a team that won four championships. Draymond used to call the NBA playoffs the Warriors Invitational. Like, this was a championship-level team. And just fighting for a play-in spot just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But I don't know. Maybe they'll decide something different next summer, and we'll have a different conversation. But I think this is a very average year for the Warriors. Same thing with the Lakers, though, too. I mean, I did think it was interesting when the reports came out that LeBron was going to take a pay cut to give the Lakers some flexibility to sign, you know, his list of guys, basically, that was put out there. You know, Harden, Jonas Valanciunas found his name on that list. I'm sure Jonas woke up ecstatic by that. Probably played a role in getting him paid 3 years, $30 million from the Wizards. You know, but the guys that were on that list are gone. They've signed elsewhere. Klay's gone. Harden's gone. Valanciunas is gone. Like,
I think DeRozan's the only one left.
Yeah, DeRozan's on the list. I don't know if he makes the Lakers Like, DeRozan's a great player to have the ball in his hands in the closing moments, right? He's a good, he's a great clutch time player. But he's still kind of that analog player in digital age. Like, he's not a three-point shooter. And the Lakers, one of their biggest problems last year was not having three-point shooting. They were an efficient three-point shooting team. Like, they were eighth in the NBA. But then they were 26th, I think, in attempts per game. And that's not how you win in 2024. So, I don't know how that makes a ton of sense for them. I think it's still on the table, for sure, as we record this on Monday night. But I don't know that that makes them measurably better. So, I mean, what seems most likely, Mark, is that we get LeBron back on a max deal, 3 years, $150 million, and they kind of run back most of the group they had last season and hope that, like, Austin Reeves, Rui Hachimura, D'Angelo Russell, all these guys discover the magic they had 2 years ago and not kind of the messiness of last season.
Yeah, and I don't think that's clearly going to be enough. I mean, I think J.J. Redick, because of the way he can have better relationships.
Sorry, let me add Dalton Connect to that. Dalton Connect, who apparently is now going to become Larry Bird. Everybody loves Dalton
Connect. They got the Connect 4 jersey ready for him.
I do love that, Mark, not to interrupt you here, but I do love that this draft went from being called like absolute dog shit by everyone for like 4 months to now it's like, well, the Lakers got this guy in the teens and this guy was available in the 20s and that second round pick is going to be an impact player. Like, you can't have it both ways. Either this draft sucks or it's good in spots. Like, I don't, that part of it befuddled me.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was in between. I remember talking to some people before the draft. They said, hey, it's not clear there's a generational star at the top, but they're still quality players and intriguing players. So,
Dalton Connect, Mark's slipping as far as he did. I want to know why. Like, I think it's most likely defense, right? I don't think he's a good defensive player. And that you can't play in the NBA if you're not at least serviceable on the defensive end. There have been a lot of guys, Mark, you know, that have been great shooters that haven't gotten real NBA minutes because they are liabilities on the defensive end. So he's going to have to prove that he can defend before they roll him out there on the floor for big minutes.
Yeah, no one's told me this directly, but I also wondered, you know, was the fact that he played in college for 4 years almost held against him? I mean, that can be a good form of currency that, hey, he's experienced and all that, but are they evaluating him through a curve almost where it's like, oh yeah, he's getting all these good numbers, but it's against underclassmen and this is misleading. But I think at the very least, he can provide some positional needs. The Lakers need a lot more outside shooting. I think he can do that. He can provide some rotation minutes. But I think the broader point that you're making about the Lakers, even if J.J. Redick taps into all his potential advantages of relationship capital with LeBron and potentially being able to relate better to even, you know, the role players and his use of analytics and the three-point shot and possible in-game adjustments, I think that his presence alone is only due for maybe single-digit win improvements from last season. Like, this, the Lakers' struggles last season largely had to do with a mix of overlapping injuries to some of their core rotation guys and a flawed roster outside of LeBron and AD. And that's the same thing that's happening this season. And then the other thing that we've hit on numerous times is this idea that because LeBron and Anthony Davis mostly played healthy last season, that does not mean that that can happen again this season, because LeBron's another year older and AD's injury history is what it is. And so, yeah, they're in very vulnerable times. And this idea that continuity is going to get them to another level just because continuity has been the calling card for other championship teams in recent years, it doesn't add up, because the continuity for the other teams worked because they had good talent.
I think the play-in tournament in the West could be awesome. Like, big-time names in the play-in tournament. Like Warriors,
LeBron,
Lakers,
and Steph again.
Clippers, throw the Suns maybe in that mix. We can get the hallway series in the play-in tournament, the one-game series in the play-in tournament. Look, this is, it's a new NBA, and there's a certain way you have to build a team. And if you don't have the right pieces, the only way to do that is to blow the whole thing up and start from scratch. Like, it's the truth. And hope that your scouts are smart enough to identify top young talent and build out that way. You can't spend your way to success anymore. Just being in a desirable market isn't enough. You've got to do things a certain way in today's NBA. And some of these kind of legacy teams, Lakers, Warriors, to a degree the Clippers, they haven't done it. And I think they're going to pay the price for that next season. Last thing I want to talk to you about, speaking of teams building a certain way. I thought Oklahoma City had a fantastic couple of weeks, right? You know, a week or so back, they acquire Alex Caruso from Chicago. I mean, Alex Caruso was a guy everybody wanted, and they got him by dealing Josh Giddey straight up. And Josh Giddey, I think, is going to turn out to be a pretty good player. Like, Josh Giddey is 21 years old and is a big, long point guard who just has a problem with his shot. And because of that, he really was superfluous in Oklahoma City. Like, they didn't need him. That's why he was, you know, talked to about coming off the bench next year. You bring Caruso into the Thunder, and all of a sudden, you have got kind of Boston-level defense at those wing spots with Shea, with Lu Dort, with Caruso. Jalen Williams can defend. Like, you've got a real defensive rotation in that backcourt. I love the fit of Caruso. And then, you know, you go out and make a deal for Isaiah Hartenstein. And this guy, he is really good. Like, I didn't know what he was when he came over from the Clippers to the Knicks, but the way he played in New York, the aggressiveness he has on the glass, particularly the offensive glass, which should be a huge help to Oklahoma City. He's an excellent passer. He makes quick decisions. Like, this guy is a legit starting center in today's NBA. And if Oklahoma City was missing anything last year, it was size, strength, rebounding in the middle. And you get Hartenstein, and he solves that problem. He does. You know, I don't know how many minutes him and Chet will play together. I would guess they start together, and then down the stretch, you see Oklahoma City kind of going with whatever lineup works, right? Like, probably Chet back at the five, some smaller players at the wing positions, and build it out that way. But having Hartenstein on that in that rotation, I think makes them measurably better. I thought Oklahoma City did outstanding this offseason.
Yeah. Well, Thunder's number one in the West. And I mean, you know, they had the top seed this past year, but I think from a depth perspective, chemistry, they're going to get the one seed and get to the NBA Finals. I mean, they have a complete team and they are riding the continuity card correctly because they have a great young core. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is a star, and all these issues that we saw other teams have to wrestle with the second apron, they don't have to worry about that right now until years down the line because they have a young core together. They don't have to make those tough decisions financially because these are all attractive rookie scale type of contracts. And yeah, it's going to be a fun NBA Finals between Boston and Oklahoma City. I would still give it to Boston because they have a really good thing going, but I really love the team chemistry that Oklahoma City has. And I think when you look at the depth, I can't think of any type of weakness. Like, they've addressed every positional need that they have on both ends of the floor. Great weak wing defense. You mentioned the rebounding. They addressed that with Hartenstein. And then their offensive depth. They have great playmaking. Shea knows how to get to the basket, get to the free throw line, hit it from outside, and he knows how to ensure a well-run offense that's based off of driving kicks and ball movement.
You know, the other thing with the Thunder, and I noticed this when they were making all these deals, is that they are now starting to amass a lot of tradable contracts, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Isaiah Joe opts out, gets himself a new deal at a manageable figure. Hartenstein is a big-ish number, but certainly in today's NBA, you can deal that. Alex Caruso, you can deal. Lu Dort, you could potentially deal. Like, they now have a roster of a bunch of guys that they could potentially deal. When you couple that with the gazillion first-round picks that they have, they are a dangerous team on the trade market as early as this season, because they could have, and I'm looking at my spreadsheet with the Thunder picks, they could have as many as four first-round picks in the 2025 draft, which is widely regarded as one of the best drafts we've seen in a while. Like, at the top, Cooper Flagg, some of the other guys there, all the way down to the middle stages of the draft. This is a top-heavy and deep draft. So Oklahoma City's got their own first in 2025. They've got Philadelphia's top six protected pick. They're going to get that. Miami's top 14 protected pick, maybe they get that. Utah top 10 protected. We'll see what Utah does with Lauri Markkanen. That's another guy. Lauri Markkanen, I think, is going to get traded because Danny Ainge, as good as any GM, Mark, smells blood in the water. And I think there's blood in the water with teams out there like the Warriors, like the Rockets, who are looking to add a piece to their team. And if they can add an all-star like Markkanen, I think the Jazz might do that. So you've got that. You've got two pick swaps as well, but the Clippers not going to do that. Houston probably not going to do that. So could have four first-round picks in an incredibly deep draft. Tradable assets. Like, I don't know who's available right now and who will be available that makes sense for them. They may just say, you know what, screw it. We've got a team that can win. Why would I do anything? But if there is, like, a legitimate make-sense star that comes available, Oklahoma City can get it. Like hypothetically, if Giannis was like, I want out of Milwaukee, is there anybody more equipped to go and get him than Oklahoma City? Like, if Milwaukee decides they got to rebuild, Oklahoma City can hand them a ready-made rebuilding package. I'm just making that up. But, like, I just look at the Thunder as being a team to watch over the next year, 2 years, as these stars become available.
Yeah, without a doubt. Hey, let's throw on LeBron. He's a free agent. He could request the Lakers to trade. I think the bigger point is that they have these assets for if they encounter a fork in the road down the line where it's too expensive to retain their core players when they're eligible for extensions. They have a lot of guardrails that can mitigate that with making other deals or using it the traditional way with selecting those draft picks in the actual draft.
Four first rounders next year, Mark. Like, what are they going to do with four first round picks? Like, I thought they had a great draft. They draft Nikola Topic, who I watched a little bit of playing overseas. Like, he's a legit, I think, future star point guard in the NBA. Not going to play this year. They're going to have some, he's got a knee issue. Even if he was ready to come back in midseason, they're gonna probably going to tell him, screw it. Like, don't do it. Just stay out and we'll bring you back next year. Maybe we lose a guy or two and all of a sudden you're ready to step in and be their starting point guard. Like, they've just got so many assets to work with. I think they're going to be dangerous. And again, I don't know who that guy is that springs loose, that says, I want to be traded and is not happy. But whoever that player is, Oklahoma City, I think, is just sitting there ready to roll, ready to make a deal like that. Mark, good stuff, man. Always appreciate taking the time to join me here on the show. Check out Mark over at Sports Key to listen to him on Fox Sports Radio. Mark, as always, I appreciate it.
Chris, appreciate you as always, and all the best. Should be another fun next few weeks with rest of free agency, Team USA, and Summer League.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month?
They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster.
That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, oh.